Hello, I'm Kevin Moore, and welcome to another edition of The Moore Show, which is sponsored by the UFO Matrix magazine. On today's show, I'll be joined with David Icke, who is a former professional soccer player, a journalist, and network anchorman with the BBC. He was the spokesman in the 1980s for the British Green Party, and since 1990, a full-time investigator into who and what is really controlling the world. He is the author of 16 books, including Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster, and his latest book, Human Race, Get Off Your Knees, The Lion Sleeps No More. He explains it's a life-changing exposure to both the illusion we believe to be real and the way this illusion is generated and manipulated to imprison us in a false reality. David Icke, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
So, David, you've done some 16 books. Your latest book is the...
Well, there's a few more now.
Is it really? How many are we looking at now?
Well, nearing 20, I think, now.
20 books.
Something like that.
And your most recent book is The Human Race, Get Off Your Knees.
Yep.
What we're going to do here, David, I just want to go sort of to the beginning where this all started for yourself. So tell me about 1989 and what that meant to you.
Well, in 1989, I was a television presenter with the BBC doing sport and news, and also a national spokesman for the British Green Party. But I started to mentally walk away from the television because I was getting tired of what is a very vacuous world, which is very insular. It looks in on itself instead of out, very much like politics. If you ever go to the Houses of Parliament and walk around there, you'll see that the whole building and the whole place is based on looking in, not out. And so I was getting tired of this vacuous world that I lived in and worked in, so much so that I used to get it down to a fine art. I used to do all my preparation work here on the Isle of Wight, and then I would go and just do the program in London live. And when the final closing titles were running, I'd have a taxi outside revving up, and by the time the titles were over, I was sitting in the taxi heading for Waterloo to come back to the Isle of Wight. That's how much I really did not like that world. And in this same period of 1989, while my attitude to what I'm doing was getting like that more and more, I had this very strange experience whenever I was in a room alone, that I wasn't alone. And it started mildly, but throughout 1989, it built up and built up and built up. And 89 was a big year for me because the Green Party got certainly up to that point, possibly ever, probably ever actually, in Britain, the biggest vote it's ever had in the European elections. And so all that was kicking off. And as that was happening, and suddenly from talking to empty halls, as a Green Party spokesman, you were on the national news and all the rest of it. While this is happening, this sense of when I'm alone in a room that I'm not alone got more and more powerful. And funnily enough, I talked to some members of the enlightened Green Party about what was happening to me, and instead of being enlightened, thinking, "Yeah, this is interesting. What is this all about?" It started circulating around that I'd gone crazy because I was what I was saying about it. But that was sad. But then again, that whole period for me in politics was to see that politics is not the way out, it's the way in, and it's designed to keep us there. Different names on the door, but very, very much the same blueprint. Anyway, by the kind of latter part of 1989, early 1990, it was so powerful, this presence, whatever it was, and it was around March in 1990, March 1990, that I was sitting in a hotel room called the Kensington Hilton near Shepherd's Bush, where the BBC is. And this presence was so powerful in the room. It was obviously, there was something there, whatever it was. And I sat on the bed and I said, if there's something there, would you please contact me? Because you're driving me up the wall. And a very short time later, a matter of days, a week or so, maybe very, very little time later, I'm with my son, Gareth, who's now a big strapping 29-year-old singer-songwriter, who's a little boy then. And we were playing football on the seafront at Ryde here on the Isle of Wight, and then we were going to have some lunch on the railway station on the seafront in the cafe. So we go there, and it's packed. So we were going to go up in the town, and then one of the railway people stopped me to talk about football. And after the conversation was finished, I realized that Gareth wasn't there anymore. But I knew where he would be. He was in the news shop where they sell books, and I walked in there, and I said to him, "Come on, Gaz, we'll go up the town, get some lunch." And as I did so, my feet were stuck to the ground. And it was like a magnets, a burning sensation, magnets pulling my feet to the ground. And as this was happening, it wasn't a voice, but I got this very, very strong, powerful thought went through my mind. And it said, go and look at the books on the far side, which were romantic novels and stuff like that. I knew that bookshop newsagent very well, but I walked across bewildered in a kind of a daze, thinking, what the heck's going on? And in among the Mills and Boone and the romantic novels was this book with a woman's face on the front, and it was called Mind to Mind. And I picked it up because it was different to the others, and I turned it over, I read the blurb, and I saw the word psychic, which, you know, made me concentrate harder, because I thought psychic. Anyway, maybe this person would know or pick up what's going on around me. I'd never been to a psychic before, but clearly that was the way forward if I wanted to understand what was happening in terms of this presence. So I read the book in 24 hours, contacted her, and went to see her. And all I said to her was that I had arthritis, which I do, rheumatoid arthritis, so maybe a hands-on healing, which she also did, would be good and help.
Sure.
What I didn't tell her was anything about the presence or anything about what was happening to me. So I turn up, we have a couple of sessions, hands-on healing, everything's fine, and we have chats about other dimensions and all that stuff, all made sense to me. But then I went on the third time, and I'm lying on like a medical type bench, and she's working on my left knee, a few inches from my left knee, and I felt like a cobweb, a spider's web on my face, which immediately made me think that I'd read about that in a book. She said sometimes when other entities, whatever you want to call them, spirits, consciousness, try to lock into you or come into a room, you can feel like a spider's web on your face. And it was very, very blatant to me, very tangible. And about 10 or 15 seconds later, I said a word to her, because I'm still thinking, oh my goodness, I read about this in a book. She suddenly launched her head back and said, my God, I'm going to have to close my eyes for this one. This is powerful. And over the next little while, she said that she was seeing this figure in her head, which is kind of just a mental projection to give her something to focus on. All this stuff started coming out, that I was going to go out on a world stage and reveal great secrets, that I would face enormous opposition, but, quote, they would always be there to protect me, that one man cannot change the world, but one man can communicate the message that can change the world, that there was going to be a vibrational change, which was going to wake people up. It was going to break people out of their coma, their hypnotic state, and it was going to bring to the surface all that had been hidden from us. So what has been going on behind the scenes, we would begin to see. And 20 years ago, of course, there's absolutely no evidence that is any of that is happening, or any of that is going to happen. But 20 years later, it's blatant. I've just come back from a month speaking in New York, near San Francisco, Lisbon, Portugal, and Barcelona, Spain, and I've never seen anything like it since I started this. There is a global awakening going on, there's no doubt about it, and that's what I was told was going to happen 20 years ago, because of what I call the Truth Vibrations, which was the name of my first book, which I wrote after these experiences. Truth Vibrations being a vibrational change that is going to, and is, my goodness me, is bringing to the surface what has been hidden from us before.
So, okay, you were given this message from the medium. Was it difficult to adjust to hearing this message? I mean, did it feel right in your heart when you heard the message?
Yeah, well, that's a good point, because, you know, I'm introducing the sport for the BBC. I'm doing representation of the British Green Party, and here I am being told that I'm going to go out on a world stage and reveal great secrets. And one of the things it said was I was going to write 5 books in 3 years, which, I mean, you try to get 5 books published in 3 years, never mind write them. And it happened to the month when I did the fifth one and then clocked it back. It was 3 years to the month. Anyway, what happened in that experience was that it did feel right. It, your mind is going, well, this is far out, this is crazy, but something inside me said, this is true. Go with it. Go with it. Go with it. Because if you come into this reality to do something and then you hear that you're going to do it through your conscious mind, then it triggers that blueprint within you, that deeper blueprint, subconscious blueprint, that knows it's true, and that's because it knows that this is what's supposed to happen, and so your conscious mind can go, what? But something deeper says, go with it, because, you know, it knows. And because there, you know, you've got the conscious mind, which in symbolic terms can see the next turn on the river. And you've got the deeper levels of awareness that can see the river from source to sea. And it knows the bigger picture of your experience. And the conscious mind is just basically experiencing it as it goes along. And so the conscious mind will dismiss things, laugh at things that actually are true, because it's just not able to expand its perception to the levels that this intuitive knowing is coming from. And so it was that intuitive level that said, go for it, go for it. And I did. I thought, you know, by this time I'd kind of realized that you know, we are consciousness. We are eternal consciousness. We are eternal awareness, which is something a word I prefer to use. And the body is just a vehicle for that awareness to experience this tiny frequency range we call the world. And therefore, I thought, well, what's the worst I can do if I go with this? I can make a mess of one short experience in this reality. I can live with that. So we're going with it. And I went with it. And of course, there were many challenges that followed pretty soon after that.
That's right, there was. But just before we leave the medium, now this wasn't any old medium, this was Betty Shine, and she was classed as one of the greatest mediums around at her time.
Yeah.
Looking back at Betty Shine, what do you take away with it? Was you initially impressed by her abilities?
Oh, Betty was terrific, yes. I mean, she was very, very sensitive to picking these things up. And obviously, you know, when you look at the flow of life, and you look back at the events in your life from the perspective of where you are now, take my own experience. I look back at my life before I became aware of all this. And it was perfect. I mean, I became a professional footballer. First of all, going back into my earlier childhood, I rejected the system, as we call it. I spent most of my time in my school days staring out the window. I went to school because I could be with my mates and play for the football team. But the rest of it just passed me by. I just wasn't impressed by it at all. I've always been not a rebel by, you know, I'm a rebel, so I'll rebel against anything. But I've always been a rebel against imposition. When people say, you know, like, respect your elders. Well, okay. Well, respect is not there to be demanded. It's there to be commanded by respect. So, you know, it's a two-way process. So I've always questioned authority, even as a small kid. And then I became a professional footballer, which gave me the ability to focus and realize that what you put in, you get out. And then came this massive traumatic disappointment when I was 19, 20, when my football career ended with rheumatoid arthritis. I was told at that time I'd be in a wheelchair eventually. Well, and I said, you know, you must be joking. That ain't gonna happen. And they gave me a this massive, massive jar of pills. I never forget. They were called Indocid. They were painkillers for the arthritis. And I said to them, "Is this going to get rid of it?" "No, no, it's going to take the pain away." I said, "Well, what's it going to do to me?" So I got rid of them and set about getting a new career. And what I wanted to do immediately, because I'd always liked this when I was a kid, I wanted to be a journalist. And so I got a job on a newspaper, because I didn't have any paper qualifications for reasons I've explained. I got a job on a newspaper that was just about read by the people that wrote it. But the ludicrous thing is that once you get into the industry, people stop asking for paper qualifications. It's just insane.
Yeah.
And I went through radio and then into television. Now, that gave me the ability to write in a simple way for a wide audience of you know, knowledge. You have to find this fine line between not talking down to people who know a lot and not talking over the heads of people that don't know the subject very well. It's a fine line. So that helped with that. And then, of course, when I got into television, it meant that when I came out with this stuff, it wouldn't be ignored. It might be ridiculed, but it wouldn't be ignored. And then, as I say, the political thing gave me a tremendous insight into politics, how it works, and how people who appear to be antagonistic in public are anything but behind the scenes. And so where I'm going with this in terms of Betty Shine is that this was all planned a long time ago. Indeed, you know, in those very early days after the initial awakening, if you like, in 1990.
Yeah.
I was told a number of times by different psychics that I met at that time. I mean, because I was seeing quite a few psychics here and there at that time, because I was trying to get a fix on what was happening. I don't do it now, but then it was important. I was trying to get a fix on what was going on in my life, and one thing that came through was no need for arduous searching. All you need is to follow the clues. It was all agreed. It was all organized a long time ago, and so me walking into that bookshop and picking up Betty Shine's book, and then contacting Betty Shine, and then Betty Shine being the first one that started to contact that level of awareness that was able to say, "Hey, this is what you're doing, mate. Whether you like it or not, this is what you're here for." Was all planned before Betty Shine was, quote, born, before I was born, all of it. And this is how the whole thing works.
So we're going to have to just fast forward a little bit here. Let's go to the early 1990s. Now, this was a period, very briefly, where you had to face, you know, the fear of what people think. So let's just explore what happened with the Terry Wogan interview quickly.
Well, when I started to say I'm going for this after the Betty Shine experience, then a lot of things started to happen to me, synchronistic things, extraordinary synchronistic things, which included me getting sacked by the BBC. I was very young for the job that I did. I should have had decades in the job, and I had many letters, you know, of commendation for my work over the years. And then suddenly, maybe about 2 months after Betty Shine, I get this this letter from the BBC saying we're not renewing your contract. And of course, that meant that I was out of work, and I could concentrate on on all this stuff without all the other stuff getting in the way. It was very, very challenging financially, but very, very important. So again, it's all connected. It's all there for a reason. And there, so I started writing a book through 1990 called The Truth Vibrations, about, you know, what was happening to me and the way I was trying to work out what was happening to me. And so by the early part of 1991, this book was coming out, and by this time there were one or two stories starting to hit the papers that, you know, Ike's gone mad. And then when the book came out, I was asked on the Wogan Show, and I went out there, and I was wearing a turquoise shell suit, because from early 1991 I just had this this real strong urge to wear turquoise. And funnily enough, some people wrote to me and said, "What you want to wear a manufactured color for? Isn't there no such thing as turquoise? It's manufactured." Well, you know, we tell the Native Americans that, who have turquoise as a very sacred stone. Anyway,
that's right.
And the first time I ever met the great Zulu shaman, Kreda Mutwa, in South Africa, he was wearing bright turquoise from neck to foot. So this, you know, colors are vibrations. They're everything's a vibration. Colors are vibration, and this is why when you wear colors, it makes you come alive, or it makes you takes the energy, the color out of your face. It's how you interact with it. So I go on the Wogan show and basically get ridiculed for about 17 minutes, I think is how long it lasted. My life, in 17 minutes, the previous life was over. Because after that, it got a massive audience that night because of all the stuff in the paper beforehand. From that moment on, I couldn't walk down any street in Britain without being laughed at by people. I lived my life to the sound of distant laughter, sometimes not so distant. I couldn't go in a bar or a pub. I mean, that would have been uproar. And it was an extraordinarily extreme experience. I mean, a comedian only had to say my name and he got a laugh. It wasn't a joke necessary. But what that did was essentially clear me out, again, part of the journey, all planned, of the prison that most people live in, which is the fear of what other people think. Once you fear what other people think, you're not living your life anymore. You're now living theirs. You're living the version of your life that suits them, so you won't cross the threshold where they'll ridicule you. So basically, fear of what other people think puts you in a tiny, tiny box. And when you have been through the extreme of mass national ridicule that I went through for like 2 or 3 years, then you either end up, in a home somewhere, shaking in the corner, or the fire turns the steel to something that cannot be broken, and that's what happened with me. And as a result of that, I was cleared out of this fear of what other people think. So I can tell you, it's only when you step out of that fear that you realize what a box it had been before, because you don't go through mental gymnastics and mental censorship, self-censorship, when you say, well, how can I put this in a way that they won't think I'm crazy? What must I leave out so they'll think I'm credible? I don't go through that, Kevin. I just say what I feel is right, and then people have the right to decide what they make of it. I'm not trying to persuade anyone anything. The world's drowning in people doing that, and that's very, to a large extent, how we got in this mess. So that was essential for me. I mean, you don't talk about shape-shifting reptilians and moons that aren't natural objects. If you fear what other people think, you can't push the envelope, if you like. You can't push the cutting edge if you are in that state. And it's essential for anyone who's researching all this that they go to it with an open mind. They let the information be the guide, not preconceived idea or preconceived belief, and that they then communicate what they believe is right without constantly editing it and letting someone else, i.e. the public perception, set the agenda for what they say and don't say. I mean, are we going to push the cutting edge if we're doing that? And it's been it's been such a freedom, such an extraordinary freedom to be able to do that without constantly going through this self-censorship.
And as well, you know, a lot of spiritual growth at the same time.
Well, yeah. Well, what you see, this is an interesting area, because we talk about spiritual growth. I don't think there's such a thing as spiritual growth myself, because I think that what we are is infinite consciousness, infinite awareness. Everything that has been, can be, will be, all possibility. In other words, you know, when people talk about something being all that is, has been, and ever will be, it sounds kind of impossible and like crazy. But what actually those words mean, if you bring them down to the simplest terms, you're talking about something that's all possibility. So within all possibility, you've got everything and nothing, everywhere and nowhere. And that's what we are. And the question is, however, in different states of attention, points of attention, how much of that awareness are we accessing? And within the point of attention that we call the physical body, not that it is, within this reality, the point of attention is very much focused, and because of the way society is systematically structured, we're pressured and encouraged to focus on reality through the five senses. Now, that's the five senses are the way that we interact with this reality, but it's not the entirety, or even a tiny fraction of the entirety of who we are. And thus, for me, we don't have to seek enlightenment. We are enlightened, because that's our very nature, all possibility. But what we need to do is remove the barriers, the vibrational barriers, which are really perception barriers, that we throw around ourselves, what I call the bubble or the eggshell, that disconnects the five sense level of awareness from higher levels of awareness. And of course, one of the greatest of these barriers is a sense of limitation, sense of little me, sense of, oh my God, what will people think of me if I say this or I think that? And so what has happened in my life, well, pretty much all of it really, but certainly concentrated in the last 20 years, is that I've been, if you like, subconsciously guided into situations and experiences, some of them very extreme, which have peeled the onion, if you like, peeled the onion layers. And with every layer that is peeled off, you get closer and closer to that level that we all are. Not just me, we all are. And it's the programming of our perception, most of all the programming of our sense of identity. I am my body, I am my name, I am my job, that holds us in these tiny little perception bubbles, and stops us being the true magnitude of who we really are. And sometimes, as I've said in my books, life gives you your greatest experiences brilliantly disguised as your worst nightmares, because, you know, sometimes you have to face these big challenges, as I did with the ridicule and everything, because that is deleting. It's deleting a program which is stopping you being who you really can be. And it's the same with all of us. The question then is, how do you respond to that experience? You can run away, that was an option, and hide and never be seen again. Or you can say, you know, I am me, I'm free. And if you want to laugh, we'll laugh, but I'm me anyway. And then you move, you become something greater than you were before. And this is an option that anybody can do, because we're all the same if you go deep enough.
That's right. So it's not. Don't think of the pain side of it. It's an experience, and it's what you take from that experience which shapes the way you're going to go forward.
I think, you know, that's a point that I keep emphasizing, the difference between the experience and who we are. You see, I've got a chapter in the new book which says, which is called "I'm Not David Icke," because David Icke is my experience in this what we call time. It's not who I am; it's my experience. And when I see the thing in the mirror, the reflection in the mirror, I see the vehicle that my infinite awareness, me, the true me, is using to experience this reality. I mean, you know, awareness is vibrating so fast that it can't interact directly with this reality. It's like Radio 1 trying to interact with Radio 2. It's not going to happen. They're on different frequencies. So we take on these outer shells, we call bodies, holograms actually, which are vibrating within the frequency range that we want to interact with. And therefore, I can sit here and hold this phone Without the outer shell in sync with the vibration of this reality, I couldn't hold this phone. It would just fall to the floor. But the control system, which at its core understands these things, not the David Camerons and all these people, I mean the real powers in the shadows, they understand how reality basically works. And the whole structure of society, be it education, religion, science, all of it is structured to get people to and the media, my goodness, to focus on five sense reality. Because the more we do that, it's like, as I described in one of my books, it's like being the fly focused on the light on the porch, and you're so focused on the light, you're aware of nothing else. That's the idea.
Okay then, David, so what you're saying then is, I think I've read this in your book, Lifting the Veil, that what we actually perceive as being there and what is actually there, are you saying they're two different things?
Well, people look out of their eyes and they say they think they can see everything in the quote space they're looking at, but they can't. They can see a frequency range, and it's tiny. It's tiny. According to mainstream science, in terms of the mass matter that exists in this universe, in terms of what they call dark energy and dark matter, the electromagnetic spectrum is 0.005% of what exists. It's probably a lot less, actually, because a lot more exists than that's discovered so far. And visible light, which is the only frequency range that we can decode and therefore perceive, is a fraction of the 0.005%. So it's like we live within a holographic television channel, and all the other channels are sharing the same space as this channel. But we can't see them because we are only picking up one level, one frequency range. And so when things enter this frequency range from elsewhere to the observer here, they seem to appear out of nowhere. I saw this UFO, mate, and it just appeared out of nowhere, and then it disappeared into nowhere, and all that stuff. And people say, you know, what you've been drinking? What's going on? Are you taking something? But actually, all it is something's entered the frequency range we can decode. Oh, look, it's come out of nowhere, and then leaves. Oh, it's gone into nowhere. So, we a lot of the, you know, ghostly things that people talk about, and these so-called paranormal things and all the rest of it are to do with the fact that sometimes other levels of reality, other frequency ranges, if you like, are kind of in the same principle as having a radio station, and as long as you're really on the dial, then that's all you get. But yeah, you also have a situation when a frequency range is very close to the radio station that you can have interference, and you can get a bit of the other radio station at the same time as the main one. And that's what basically is happening when we see ghosts and these other so-called paranormal things. Well, that's not the only explanation for them, but it's a major one. Because we don't understand this, then we are not told this, and we're encouraged not to believe it, then of course there are so many things that are called mysteries. They're not mysteries at all. They're a piece of cake to explain and say what's actually happening. You know, you know, I keep seeing these programs, like they had one on the British television a little while ago called Strange But True, and they would kind of be about these amazing experiences that people have had, paranormal experiences, and then they would wheel on somebody from a university who would knock it on the head and say, oh no, it couldn't have happened, or give some ludicrous explanation for it, and then none of these programs ever just explained what was actually happening and why. And you can do it in 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, it's not difficult. But the idea is to keep us in ignorance of the nature of reality, because when we start to realize what it is, and therefore what we are, there's no more little me. And if there's no more little me, there's no more ability of the few to control the many, because for that to happen, the vast overwhelming majority of the many have to believe their little me. I've got no power, what can I do?
Well, we're just going to have to move on here just quickly. Now, David, you don't impose your ideas. You know, you have the right to be wrong. Yeah, or we have the right to be wrong.
Most important right of all, because otherwise someone's deciding what's right and wrong, and you're fundamentally into a situation of censorship. The right to be wrong, the right to be silly, the right to ask apparently silly questions, these are all absolutely foundation concrete of human freedom.
That's right, and we can all have different opinions, and and they could be as far-fetched as they want to be honest. Just because of people assume them to be rubbish, that most times they've not listened to the research that goes behind it.
Well, that's true. I mean, if people read what I write, and of course, you know, the latest book is 355,000 words, so you know, I don't just sketch it out over a few pages. If they read what I write and say, well, yeah, it's interesting, but I don't buy that, and I say, fair enough, not a problem. You know, but you've read it. But what you get with 99% of people who will dismiss what I say is people who don't know what I'm saying. I had this experience, Kevin, on I think it was a Channel 4 television show in which I was interviewed with a guy called, I think, Christopher French.
That's
Christopher
right. French. I saw that, yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether this appeared on the show, because I never did see it from start to finish, but I'll tell you what actually happened while we're talking. And if it wasn't in the show, it was disgraceful, because it just showed what was going on here. And he's dismissing my books. He's a psychologist or something from London University. And I said to him, you know, have you read my books? And he said, no, which was an insult to the audience for a start. And then I said to him, well, how do you know what I'm saying then? And he said, I've read it in the paper. And you know, you stand there and you're looking at what is considered a major academic. I mean, crikey, thank you God I'm not one of those if that's a major academic. And you're hearing this stuff. They're dismissing what you say and all the rest of it, and they're not even read it. Well, I read it in the paper. It must be true. You know, I mean, oh my God, beam me up, Scotty. It's mad down here. And you find this, and when people do that, they're not taking themselves seriously. Because if they were, they would find out what someone was saying before they chose to dismiss it or have a go at it. But they don't. They just get their information from the newspapers. I mean, there was a newspaper this week, the Sunday Express, that announced that nearly 20 years ago, I left England amid enormous ridicule and went to live in America. I've lived on the Isle of Wight all the way through. What are they talking about? I mean, you know, look in the phone book or just look on my website, you know. I mean, but no. I mean, so anyone that gets their information from the papers and then decides their opinions based on it, which of course is the idea of the whole manipulation, is not taking themselves seriously. And I just, it just goes in one in and out the other when people like that start having a go at me. But, you know, you're right in terms of not wanting to persuade anybody, because I don't. You know, those days of I've got all the answers, you must believe me or you're wrong, I mean, that's the old way. What I'm saying is, here's some information that you won't get from other sources. What I found here is what I found there. This is how I say it connects together. And make of it what you will. It's not just that I don't seek to persuade anybody to believe what I say. It's none of my business what they believe. It's their business, not mine. My business is to put information before people so they can have the opportunity to see it. That's the end. That's over then. It's finished, kaput. And I just go off and continue what I do. We don't need anyone else in this world telling other people what to believe. We're drowning in them.
Now, you've just mentioned there about the media system that we're in. I mean, so you would say, in your opinion, that, you know, this system that we live in has been implemented to keep us dumbed down, prisoned, from keeping us from ultimate truths. But what truths are they keeping us from, in your opinion?
Oh dear, how long you got? They're keeping us from truths on multiple levels, like the fact that there is a network of families that go back to the ancient world that actually, when you get to the top of the structure, control the banking cartel, because that's what it is. They control the political cartel, any party that has a chance of forming a government. They control the pharmaceutical cartel, the oil cartel, the biotech cartel. They own the global media. On and on it goes. And what they've created is like a transnational corporation, only it's secret societies and bloodline families. You look at a transnational corporation, and it has a headquarters. And in each country, it's got its subsidiaries. And the subsidiaries do what the headquarters tells them to do. That's why when you go into a McDonald's, for instance, in Sydney, Australia, or Moscow, or South America, you walk into the same McDonald's. And what they've structured is a similar network where they have the headquarters, the spider, as I call it, which is in Europe, places like London, Paris, Germany, Belgium. Rome, big time, and London, big time too. And that center then has subsidiaries. These are subsidiary networks of secret societies run by the families in the different countries. And so the center dictates the agenda, and just like with McDonald's or Burger King or any of them, the subsidiaries then carry out what the center dictates. And this is why when I go around the world, I think I've been to something like 53, 54 countries now, researching and talking about this, I see the same things happening in country after country, often justified by the same things, lies normally. And it's even sometimes the legislation's worded virtually identically. This is how it's possible to do it. But the whole foundation of this conspiracy is to keep humanity in ignorance of who it really is, to persuade us that we are our bodies and we are our jobs and are our names instead of them being our experience, and to pull our attention, therefore our perception of reality, of self and the world, into that level of five sense reality. And when we do that, we are, like I said earlier, we're in little me, I have no power, I'm insignificant perception mode, and that can be controlled en masse from the center. But once you open your mind to consciousness and move your point of attention out of body-mind into your higher levels of awareness, then your point of observation changes, and suddenly you start to see all the dots connecting. And, you know, the number of people that have said to me over the years, I get it now, it is so obvious, why didn't I get it before? Because before you were perceiving the world from body-mind, and seeing everything as apart from everything else, and now you're seeing it from a higher level of awareness, which is seeing how everything connects to everything else, and therefore you can see what you couldn't see before. And this is something that more and more people are going through, which is why this control system is seeking to throw more and more at us in terms of control, surveillance, suppression, because it knows humanity is waking up. In fact, there's a guy in America called Zbigniew Brzezinski, who used to be Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, big time insider in this network. Yeah. And he was saying in a speech a little while ago that humanity was going through the, he called it political awakening, it's much bigger than that, was going through the biggest political awakening in human history, well, known human history anyway. And they realize they have to up the game to try to keep this control system alive, because once you open your mind to consciousness, you're not going to be herded like sheep anymore. You're not going to be suppressed. Consciousness doesn't do suppression. Mind does suppression. And that's why they try to keep us in mind all the time. The education system's there to put us in mind. And also, the system wants to ensnare us so that we become dependent upon the system and therefore have to serve the system to get what we need for the basics of life. And this is what is happening with the student loans. the student loan conspiracy is very simple. It's to get young people in massive amounts of debt as early as possible in their lives so that they have to serve the system for the rest of their lives, yes sir, no sir, three backs full sir, to pay back the loans. It's absolutely scandalous, and this whole thing is playing out a blueprint. It wasn't people sitting round a table during the Blair government saying, oh, I've got a good idea, let's replace student grants with student loans. No, it wasn't like that at all. It was planned that that would be stage one to introduce the concept and the precedent of student loans. And then the blueprint is to turn the screw, increasing the amount of money that students, young people, have to borrow to finance their education, and so for the rest of their lives, basically, they're serving the system to pay back the original loans, and plus then they're taking on other loans of mortgages and all these this stuff that they take on, and it's about control. And apart from the violence, which was ridiculous, because what you fight, you become. We need non-violent, non-cooperation to bring this down, because the system only exists because the masses acquiesce to it and contribute to the building of their own prison. But those 50,000 students in Westminster recently, the ones that weren't violent, that is an example of the fact that, you know, more and more people are saying enough. They're saying enough at different levels of awareness of what they're actually saying enough to, because some people still think that it's one big bad government, when actually it's a coordinated global operation, and certainly national operation, instead of student loans, which goes across through party politics. And so you have a situation where, and it's so typical when the conservative liberal coalition said they were going to massively increase student loans.
That's right, they did.
And the Labour Party then had the absolute audacity to criticise them when they were the ones that brought in student loans in the first place. You know, and this is an important point in terms of politics, you know, Kevin, because we must be persuaded that we have some kind of choice, political choice, because if we don't, we realize we live in a one-party tyranny. And then when we do, going under different names, Labour, Liberal Democrat, and Conservative. And so what happens? I've been saying this for years, and what's going on now, I mean, I almost laugh at it. If it wasn't so tragic, it would be hilarious. But you have two parties, so we've got three now, the Liberal Democrats, who, you know, they knock on the door and someone says, what are your policies? And the Liberal Democrat says, what would you like them to be? And then he says to the next guy at the next house, as we're seeing with Clegg now over student loans particularly. But what you have is a multi-party system, so it's called. Normally there's one or two parties that have any chance of forming a government, sometimes three. And the party in government carries out the agenda to increase the power of the state, to bring in the Orwellian surveillance and all the rest of it. And the party in opposition then criticizes it, because they can't do anything about it, so they criticize it, and the party in government introduces it. Then we have a ludicrous farce called an election, and the two parties change places. Now the party in government that was criticizing that agenda before starts to continue to introduce it. This is what's happening now with the conservative liberal introduction of more and more Orwellian things they criticized in opposition. And then the party that was in government before and introduced the agenda is now not in government, so can't introduce the agenda. So its role now is to criticize the agenda it introduced before, so that we can continue this illusion that there is political choice. And the best thing people can do in elections is not to vote, from my perspective. You know, don't vote, it only encourages them. Because while we vote in a rigged system, we're giving credibility to the rigged system.
Yeah.
And if we don't vote, then in vast numbers, then something's got to happen. in terms of the system, because the people are rejecting it. And people say, well, you know, if I don't vote, so the so-and-sos might get in. It doesn't matter, because it's just a mask on the same face the other people are, you know. This is a big thing that's happening now, Kevin, you know, that more and more people who have a natural antipathy to injustice and unfairness and corruption are now beginning just to start making the major, major step of crossing that line where they move from thinking all this injustice is just various greedy people and power-seeking people, and realize that actually it's coordinated by a very few people, and the people that are, or the force that is imposing its will upon British people is also imposing its will on Spanish people and American people and South African people.
Yeah, and we're going to get back to who this group, or try to narrow down just who we think this group is. But I mean, just on the issue of the student issues there, I mean, you know, there's no job for these students that left the year before, the year before that. There's no jobs for my fellow students that are going to leave this year. And I think in the end of the day, it's going to be the young people who are going to, you know, make the difference, at least start to make a difference. If we've demonstrated that through the strikes, great. The peaceful ones, of course.
Yeah, the point is, though, Kevin, you know, that, you know, people look now. The thing you say about young people is very, very true. I mean, I'm 58. What have I got? You know, the 10 years left, maybe 20? I don't know. But the young people today, the children today and the young people today have got an enormous amount of life in this reality. You've got the infinite life, but enormous amounts of life in this reality still to go. And when you observe the world today and the extremes we're reaching of police state Orwellian imposition, then just think a few decades from now. You think a few years from now, but you think a few decades from now, where our children, young people, and grandchildren are going to be alive, and what it's going to be by then. So we need to come together, no matter what age, no matter what color, creed, religion, political persuasion, none of it. It's all rubbish. It's all manufactured fault lines to divide and rule us. What we need to do is to come together and to cease to acquiesce and submit to our own enslavement. And then the control system's lost its power because, you know, not only is it not, in terms of numbers, big enough to impose itself upon the population physically, can do in small areas here and there, but not in general. It has to target members of the target population to fill the jobs of law enforcement and dark suit government administrators. And when we cease to acquiesce to our own enslavement will end. And it's a simple thing, and it's a simple truth, and when the penny finally drops, then this nonsense will end, but not until.
I suppose all this comes down to as well, I mean, you know, the financial system hasn't worked. It's collapsed. Would you say it's been helped to be collapsed, or...?
Well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, there's the agenda for a world central bank dictating all global finance for like the last 15 years. And now major people in politics and finance are saying we need a world central bank. Why? Because of the economic mayhem that has been created by the banks, which, as I said earlier, are ultimately controlled by the same network of families. And so, yes, they are trying to cause as many economic problems as possible so that they could say, because, you know, as I said in 2008, the three-stage plan was this in September 2008. First of all, crash the world economy so that people see there's a major problem. Okay, did that. Second, get governments to hurl vast amounts of cuckoo land borrowed non-existent credit money at the banks and for it to disappear. They've done it, leaving governments in no position to react again if there's another crash of the economy. The idea is at stage three, which is coming, is to crash the economy again, and then without the governments able to react, the financial system controlled by these families comes forward and says, oh, the only way to sort out this mess is to restructure global finance. hey presto, it will be a world central bank and ultimately a single electronic currency. That's the way they do it. But they don't have to be allowed to do it if enough of the people become aware of what's going on and will not acquiesce and will not comply with it.
Well, that's the bit of the problem, though, isn't it, though? You know, a friend of mine said to me not too long ago, he said he'd rather be told what to do, told what to think, and to not really want to think outside the box that mainstream reality says is the only reality that can exist. There's a lot of people like that.
Yes, there are, and unless they break out of the box, then they might as well, you know, I don't know where they want to put the barcode or the microchip, which is the other part of this agenda that I've been writing about for 20 years. But that they should just bow their head and let the microchip go in, and then they won't have any thoughts of their own whatsoever. I mean, you know, we create our own reality, Kevin. And if people like him are quite happy for that, that's what they'll get. But there's vast and vastly growing numbers of people that don't want that and are beginning to realize that that is what the plan is for them, and that they are going to that they are already starting to rebel. But we need to get more and more streetwise and educated, if you like, about who's behind this, why, the techniques of manipulation, and all the rest of it, and then we'll be much more savvy in terms of responding to it in an effective way. And you know, it doesn't take everybody to bring about massive change and to bring this system down so we can build a fairer, more equitable and free one. It just takes a large number of people, not even half. And so those people that you've just described, well, they'll just be spectators. They'll be spectators in what is coming up, because they won't be participants because they don't want to be. But it will be done despite them, because it will be done. This control system's coming down. It won't seem like that for a few years. It will seem like the opposite. But, you know, sometime in the next 10 years, this is coming down. This is coming down. I ain't leaving here till it does.
But if, you know, if mainstream print, TV, radio, you know, if they say it's not true or correct, then they have to be right, and you know, we never have to question them. Is that right, David?
Well, that's what you need to do. Yes, if you want to give away your right to freedom, your right to thought, your right to consciousness, in the end, your right to any kind of awareness at all beyond that of a robot or a computer terminal. But if you want to be who you really are, then we need to start expressing it, which is uniqueness, which is a refusal to be suppressed, a refusal to be silenced, a refusal to be told what you are, what you will do, and what you will not do, just because the system tells you. You know, and so I've been using an image in my talks for a long time now, and I'm still using it because it's becoming more and more and more relevant, and that is of a fork in the road, and that's where we are. There are people like the person you mentioned who will take their box down one fork in the road, and you know, they'll get more and more controlled to the point where they just don't have any thoughts of their own that aren't externally implanted. But there are more and more people taking the other fork in the road and saying we're not having it. And eventually it's that mentality that will prevail, because the number of people in full awareness of this conspiracy in terms of making it happen are beyond tiny compared with the global population, beyond tiny. And they can only prevail by keeping us in ignorance, by keeping us in fear, and by dividing and ruling us and putting us at war with ourselves. And what have I just described? I've just described the society is today. And it is like that, and it's been like that through known human history, because that is the only way so few people can control the lives of so many.
Well, it's like you said before, you know, in your opinion, there's been a suppression of knowledge and information. obviously there must be some light at the end of the tunnel. There must be we're approaching 2012. I mean, have you done much work in regards to where we could be going?
Well, it's been at the heart of everything that I've done from the start, really. In 1991, when all this ridicule broke, I was described as the prophet of doom, which is the absolute opposite of what I am. Anyone sees my talking events will realize that. Right back 20 years ago, one of the first things I was told about was this vibrational change that was coming, what I call the truth vibrations. And I have seen it impact more and more on people's perceptions. It's kind of breaking up the density, breaking up the concrete, breaking up these layers of the onion I talked about earlier. And I'm seeing now people opening their minds and getting it, who you thought would have been a lost cause not long ago. I mean, I was walking down a hotel room in Santa Fe last year, a hotel corridor, and a man was coming where I was speaking, and one man came up to me walking the other way, and he said, I've come from Austin, Texas to see you tomorrow. He said, 3 months ago, he said, I would have laughed at you, and I did. I thought you were crazy. He said, and now I understand exactly what you're saying. So that's how fast it can happen. And it's happening more and more like that to more and more people. I mean, it's just extraordinary. Because I travel a lot, I see that it's a global awakening too, not just one in England and America or whatever. And the more the system collapses, the more people will be open to looking at other things in terms of explanations of what's going on. And that's happening too. And for me, what we're going through is a change of era. In Asia, they talk about yugas or epochs, ages, different ages of human experience. And we're coming out of an age of suppression, a limitation, and manufactured ignorance. And we're going into a new era of expansion of consciousness, freedom, celebrating the uniqueness, celebrating diversity. And at the moment, we're at the cusp of the two. And the control system, which represents the old epoch, is now throwing everything at us, including the kitchen sink and the plug, and will do even more in the next few years, to try to hold on to its power. But it's doomed, because the energetic, therefore, information foundation on which it's based is disappearing. The foundations are collapsing beneath their feet. And, 10 years from now, maybe before, we're going to see the tipping point where this stuff comes down, and we're going to then have another big challenge, which is creating a new human society out of the debris of the old. But as Einstein said, in words to the effect of, you cannot solve problems by with the same level of consciousness that created them. Therefore, this consciousness shift has to take place, has to manifest for us to move on to a greater level of experience and a society that is a pleasure and a joy to live in. Because what happens when you replace the same level of consciousness with the same level of consciousness, this is what's happening when conservatives replace labor, or labor replace conservatives, or Republicans replace Democrats, or vice versa, then the same level of consciousness goes on expressing itself in the same way and nothing changes. So it's this consciousness shift is fundamental to everything. This moving our point of attention, awareness, perception, observation is essential, because right. Unless that moves, society can't change. Fortunately, it is moving, and society is going to change, and change vastly for the better once we've been through some big challenges and sorted out this nonsense in the next few years.
But it's the case, though, isn't it, David? What's going to replace the current financial system? I mean, are we talking about bartering?
Well, this is the point. You see, the present financial system and the present global society in general is a manifestation of the present state of human consciousness. A human consciousness, by the way, which is in a state that will allow itself to be manipulated and suppressed and told what to do, by what it perceives to be authority. So at any point, the society we live in is merely a holographic projection of the collective human state of consciousness or lack of it. And we're moving now into a period where human consciousness is going into an expanded stage as these onion rings come off and the programming starts to break down. And therefore, the society we live in and how it's organized and how it interacts will be an expression of that greater level of awareness. So it will be a very different society. And things that we perceive now to be impossible and these are insuperable problems will be shown not to be. They appear to be insuperable because of the limited level of consciousness that's observing them and is behind them. And, you know, what more ludicrous situation can you have that when you go to a bank and you borrow £50,000 or whatever, all that bank does is type £50,000 into your account. It's not money it has. It's not precious metals it has or anything like that. It just types into your account £50,000.
That's right.
Because the same families that have controlled politics have controlled the banks. And legislation has been passed to allow banks to lend at least, my God, it's at least 10 times what they have on deposit. And so all this debt that's having people thrown out of their homes and all the rest of it is actually debt on money that has never, does not, and will never exist. It's called credit. Credit does not exist. It's something in theory. And so when you go into a bank and you borrow £50,000, it is creating that out of nothing called credit, because it can lend 10 times and more what it has on deposit. And so every time you put a pound in a bank, you're giving that bank the right to lend 9 or 10 it doesn't have, called credit. Now, the other interesting thing is that when you get your £50,000 in that way out of nothing, and you say buy a car, and you go give a guy a check for £15,000 from the £50,000, he then puts it in his bank, and now his bank can lend 10 times that. And the whole thing goes on and on and on and on. And from that initial loan, out of nothing, fresh air money called credit, of £50,000, fantastic amounts of non-existent money are then able to be created by the banking system as that original 50,000 moves around. And there's another vital point for people to understand here, and that is that when you borrow the £50,000, they are creating, in theory, what they call the money supply and all the rest of it, money in circulation, £50,000. But you're not paying back £50,000. You're paying back £50,000 plus interest. Now, that interest is never created. And therefore, built into the system by design, cold, calculated design, there is never even nearly enough money in circulation, kind of figment money or not, to pay back all the outstanding debts. So people losing their homes, their land, etc., is built into the system. Now, when we have a boom and there's more money in circulation, that can be hidden a little bit. But when we have a recession and even more money is taken out of circulation, then that fundamental built-in on-purpose flaw, there's never enough money to pay back all the debt, becomes more obvious. Because there's even less money around, then it becomes more obvious, the effects of that. Yeah. And this is why we're having people now all over the world in vast, vast numbers being foreclosed in terms of their homes. And they're being foreclosed by banks who were behind the problem that made them lose their jobs, meant they couldn't pay their mortgage. I mean, how much more do we need, human race, before we look in the mirror and get some pride back and get some backbone back and say we're not having it anymore? Because every time they give us an outrageous abuse, like the banks throwing people out of their homes because of problems the banks have caused, when you are put through a radiation device, full body scanner in an airport. When your children have their naked bodies photographed, and the photographs are going to be passed around the paedophile networks, and when they're saying that if you refuse to have constant radiation when you go through airports, very dangerous for your health, you won't be able to fly. And in America, where they, if you at least have the right to refuse the radiation, then you have these invasive pat-downs where they touch every area of your bloody body, including your children's. I mean, every time we do not resist that, every time we do not say enough, no more, then they'll just say, okay, well, there wasn't any resistance to that, so we'll go even further next time. When are we going to draw that line in the sand? I think it's starting to be drawn now, and about bloody time.
But what about those listeners out there who would feel that the UK is a sort of free country to live in compared to sort of, you know, China, for example, where there's internet blockages and...
Well, China today, Kevin, is Britain tomorrow. And if people can look at Britain now, where you're going to pass and rising at least 300 surveillance cameras every day, where they're now saying that they are bringing it into law that they can follow where you go on the internet and they can look into your emails and all the rest of it, when our children are being subjected to surveillance and fingerprinting and iris scanners and cameras in the schools, so they can't do anything without being watched. I mean, if people think they're free, okay, well, they're a lost bloody cause, mate, if they think this is freedom. Britain and America are global laboratories. It starts out here and then gets exported to the rest of the world. I know that because I travel the world all the time. And the biggest laboratory in terms of the global Orwellian state that they want is China. And, you say there about, you know, the way the internet is firewalled off in China. Yes, it is. But in America, people like Jay Rockefeller, who's one of these families, they're trying to get censorship of the internet in America. They're doing the same in Britain. Mandelson was trying to do that before the last election. And there's a guy in America, one of fake fraud Obama's, which I said he was from the start and got a lot of abuse for saying it. I don't get abuse for saying it now. Fake fraud Obama's czar, one of these positions where they cover certain subject areas, a guy called Cass Sunstein, has actually gone public in a document and called for people with conspiracy theories to be either banned from having them or articulating them or taxed for having them, right? So, you know, I say to this to people, what you are looking at now is not the way it's meant to stay. What you're looking at now is just the latest step on the road to a global Orwellian fascist tyranny that would make George Orwell wince. Now, when are you going to get your head out of the sand and face it? And interestingly, in body mechanics, to have your head in the sand, you have to be on your knees. The two go together. And when we get our head out of the sand and face it, we might have a chance of getting off our knees, which is what we need to do, and pretty damn quick too.
Okay, well, your current work, I mean, what are you working on next, David, just very quickly?
Well, I'm going to speak in Amsterdam in about 10 days, and then I'm then going to have a break over Christmas. Well, I say a break from traveling. Yeah. And then I'm going to talk in the Ukraine, which will be a first time in what you perceived as Eastern Europe. And more new countries are asking me to go there. I've spoken recently in the Czech Republic, in Spain and Lisbon. These are all new countries in terms of speaking. I'm going on in March to a really big event in Los Angeles. And then also at the same time, I'm doing Mexico. That's another new country. I've just been asked to go to Brazil. That's another new country. It's happening. It's happening. It's happening. Mm-hmm. And in the next 10 years, it's going to happen enough for this nonsense to be brought down.
Sure. And your website for the listeners?
DavidIke.com.
Well, David Icke, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure, Kevin. Thanks ever so much, mate.
To find out more information on David Icke, go to davidicke.com or visit my site, themoreshow.co.uk, and look up David Icke under past guests. Until next time, be safe.